Welcome back to our study of Daniel. We're going to be picking up at the end of chapter 4 and then into chapter 5. Some of the most memorable scenes, arguably in all of the Old Testament, certainly the case here in Daniel. There are just so many memorable scenes from the men in the furnace thus far. And into the picture comes to our minds with Nebuchadnezzar under the curse when he becomes bestial, animalistic. And then today, the handwriting on the wall, the Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parson written there. So eager to jump into this with you and explore it. Let's begin in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. All right, so looking at chapter 4, verse 28 and following, we had covered this section 28 through 33 at the end of last class period. Of course, this is the fulfillment of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He has had ample opportunity to realize that there is one true God, and it isn't Bel slash Marduk, his God. And he has grown fat and sassy and hubristic right along with his kingdom. And of course, he thinks that as the ruler of Babylon that rules the earth, that he has done this all himself. And he is all that and a bag of chips. And of course, the watchers, this holy council of angels, determines otherwise, obviously in consultation with God. And so they bring him this vision. The vision is interpreted and fulfilled. So chapter 4, verse 28, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar at the end of 12 months. I mean, look how patient God continues to be. At the end of 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, and the king answered and said, "Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty." A little self-absorbed, to say the least. While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven, "O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you, and you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox." And 7 periods of time certainly seems longer than 7 days. Doesn't necessarily need to be 7 years, though that's what many speculate. It could just as easily be 7 weeks or 7 months. I mean, a significant period of time, especially when you consider the physical manifestations of the curse. So at any rate, you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men. That's the take-home point. And in a sense, that's the thesis of all of Daniel, is that God rules over the affairs and nations of men. He hasn't relinquished that. The left-hand kingdom belongs to him also. Amazing. So this then will become a recurring theme, especially here in chapters 4 and then in a moment, chapter 5. The Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. Verse 33, immediately the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. Oh yeah, and I should say, okay, we'll get there. He was driven from among men and ate grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers. And the Greek, interestingly, says as long as a lion's mane. And then his nails were like those of a bird or like bird's claws. So interesting that the Greek adds in an extra dimension. So you'd have the ox, the lion, and the bird. So he becomes bestial, lower than human, subhuman, in this punishment from God. Not fit to reign over humanity, not even really fit to live as a human being. 34, at the end of days, I, Nebuchadnezzar. It's just fascinating that you get these kind of first-person interjections. I mean, it leads to all kinds of sort of, even if simplistic, questions of wonder. Was there some co-authorship between Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar on key parts? Did Nebuchadnezzar leave a sort of written diary or a verbal account of what occurred that he gives to Daniel? It's interesting to consider. Be that as it may, at the end of days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion. Now, we've heard this echoed, so this ties in with the theme that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. So also then, a repeating that his dominion or his reign is an everlasting dominion or reign. We've seen that in chapter 4, verse 3, in chapter 2, verse 44. Now we see it here again. And his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the hosts of heaven. Which, of course, the host of heaven is like military language, the army of heaven. And the Greek translates that the dunamai to Uranu, so the powers of the heaven. So he does his will among the powers of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. Really kind of reflecting those two different kingdoms, the kingdom of heaven and the hierarchy of heaven, the kingdom of earth and the hierarchy of earth. As the Lord who reigns over all, he does his will in both spheres or in both kingdoms, to import my own language. And of course, then, astonishingly, Christ, as true human being, when he says all authority in heaven and on earth have been given to me, now we have Christ, we have God setting whom he will over the principalities and powers of the heavens and the earth in the man, Jesus Christ. Astonishing. His ascension is his coronation, and he reigns to this day in that capacity. Okay, so I left off right after the semicolon toward the end of verse 35, just picking up there. And none can stay his hand or say to him, "What have you done? Call him into judgment." So the Lord has an everlasting kingdom and dominion. He is way above the powers of heaven and the powers of earth. None can stay his hand when he moves his hand to do what he wills, or say to him, "What have you done?" Call him into judgment after the fact. He's that much higher. All right, verse 36, at the same time my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. So again, as we saw in the initial dream, even though the stump is cut down, it's banded with iron and bronze. This idea that it would be permitted to regrow is intimated there in that language and imagery. So here is the fulfillment of that. My majesty and splendor returned to me. My counselors and my lords sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me by God on account of his recognition of God. He's humbled himself before the Lord, and so the Lord exalts him. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride he is able to humble. All right, very quickly, next line, King Belshazzar, not to be confused with Belteshazzar, which is Daniel's name. It's a different king. But at least at this point, we're led to reflect on the reality that this pagan king became a Christian king. And that's sort of, at least at this point in the narrative, where it's left. After all of Nebuchadnezzar's failures, this final episode in his life, this final episode in his reign, leads him to be a Christian. He is worshiping the King of Heaven, and that's that. The next thing we know, there's a new king. In fact, between chapter 4 and chapter 5, best guess is 23 to 30 years pass. So there's quite a jump from Nebuchadnezzar to Belshazzar. Let me see if I can find my note here in the commentary. I'll just give you a brief glimpse. It's not super exciting. Yeah, here we go. So if you're keeping track of dates in any way, Nebuchadnezzar dies in 562. After him come a number of kings down to Belshazzar. So immediately after him, you get Emel-Marduk, who reigns for a period of roughly 2 years, 3 years. Nergalesar, who reigns for 4 or 5 years. Labashi-Marduk, who reigns for just a few months. And then Nabonidus, who reigns for a lengthy period of time and is really a co-regent with Belshazzar. So these are all in the line of Nebuchadnezzar. We'll see later in chapter 5 that Belshazzar is even called a son of Nebuchadnezzar. In fact, he'd be down the family line quite a bit. Nabonidus, his father, was reigning, but due to some politics, ended up being a co-regent with Belshazzar, kind of exiled himself for a period of his reign. So Belshazzar is the one who's in charge here. And he reigns something like 53 to 39, or 50 to 39, somewhere in that chunk of time. Anyway, if you want to zoom all the way out, 23 to 30 years pass between chapter 4 to chapter 5. And we'll see some things have changed. Not just the king, but Daniel no longer has a privileged status per se. And as this chapter unfolds, we'll find out some remarkable things. But let me pause there. Let me see if you have any questions or any comments on just what we've hit so far.
That's pretty close, not to be confused with Daniel's Babylonian name, right?
But, right.
But they're like a couple of letters off or consonants.
Yeah,
off.
Okay. Yeah. And I don't know. I didn't read in the commentary. I didn't even think to go looking for that in any other source. What, if any, difference there is? Of course, Belteshazzar, you can hear the name Bel, the false god, in this name given to Daniel by the Babylonians. And then Belshazzar, so I don't know what the difference is in that one syllable. Yes, sir.
Oh, that phrase, what have you done? You immediately answered what my question was. That's implying judgment. Mm-hmm. But it's funny how that question could be asked a different way. It could be asked, like, legitimately, like, what have you done? You know, like, what have you made here? What, you know, what's your will? But the way it's being asked there is implying, mm-hmm. like, you shouldn't have done this, right?
So. Yeah, yeah, like you're sitting in judgment over God, or you're second-guessing or questioning what he's done.
But it would be good for us to actually ask that, like, what have you actually done?
Sure, sure, to explore the works of God. Yeah, the judgment of God, of course, is much more common than we think, because that's at the root of all unbelief, and especially the faux excuses that people come up with. They'll say, well, why would I believe that God is good if the world looks the way it does? Or they've suffered some personal tragedy, and they go, well, I could never believe in a God who, you know, let grandma die or let my child die or something like this. And I mean, all of these are just forms of saying to God, what have you done? I'm the I'm the judge here. I know what's right and wrong. You've been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Therefore, I don't have to believe in you. Right? Which is, I mean, insane, but how people reason all the time. All right, should we jump into chapter 5 proper then? Let me see what's helpful to do this before or after. Yeah, let's do this before. Let me just give you a little bit from Steinman's commentary. It'll kind of set the stage, because as I was reading through this, I felt like it was a little bit of a jarring transition. So Belshazzar, this new king of Babylon, you're going to see that he falls into the same pride of Nebuchadnezzar. Judgment for Belshazzar and the Neo-Babylonian dynasty meant that God was fulfilling his promise. Already in Jeremiah, God had prophesied that the captivity of his people in Babylon would last 70 years. So in other words, God knows exactly how long this is going to last. He's keeping the timeline. No one or no thing is going to be able to subvert that. Babylon's fall to the Persians some 60 years after Jerusalem was first given into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar in 605 BC, and the first captives, including Daniel, were taken to Babylon, was the first step in keeping this promise. Jeremiah had promised that the Medes would be God's instrument for punishing Babylon, and Daniel dutifully records the fall of the city and kingdom to the Medes and the Persians. That's coming up in this chapter, who were led by, quote-unquote, Darius the Mede. God can keep these promises because he is the God who governs all earthly history for the sake of his redeemed people, the church. He deposes and raises up worldly kings, as exemplified by the succession of the four kingdoms in chapter 2. And I think that's the key point I wanted to bring out, that already as we see the Babylonian Empire fall to the Persians slash Medes, we're seeing the fulfillment of the dream interpreted in chapter 2, remember the great colossus or the great statue, and it's all brought down. It has four parts, these four kingdoms, and they're all brought down by this little stone, right? And that's going to be Christ, because this little stone brings down all four kingdoms and then grows from a stone into a mountain that fills the whole earth. So the point being that chapter 5 is already the fulfillment of what was prophesied in chapter 2. All right, so that'll give us the background we need then, I think, to enjoy this more fully. Chapter 5, verse 1, King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the thousands. So, you know, it's just government doing government stuff. And I mean, no, there's 1,000 of them. Bureaucracy run amok. They're all drinking wine. Well, there's some astonishing things, of course. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem, be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods. And now here, this is Daniel's description, so it's great. Praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So he's already mocking them. You know, here they are toying with a living God while they've just got dead gods all around them. So that's one of the ways in which this drips with irony. Now, since most of you have probably read Daniel before, it would be worth leaping ahead to verse 30. Just glimpse it real quick. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Now, what does that mean? So you have to think a little of just the practicality of warfare. That means that the army of the Persians was already surrounding the city. And everyone in the city would have been aware of it, including Belshazzar and his 1,000 government officials who are all there. So there's, and I think that that helps explain what it is they're doing. So they're celebrating their gods. They're having this great victory feast. Even though they're surrounded, they assume that their gods are going to cause them to prevail. And in fact, in grabbing, and maybe they grabbed others, but of course this is Daniel's interest. So he mentions the fact that they grabbed the vessels of gold and silver that used to belong to the temple. They're, in their minds, they're saying, look, our gods have triumphed over all these other gods. Our gods have triumphed over all these other peoples. We are absolutely sure, absolutely secure and certain that our gods will prevail and give us the victory, even when they're surrounded. So this is extreme hubris and religious zeal pointed toward dead idols rather than the living God. So a point of irony then that just sort of drips in this text is as you're first introduced to it, you don't get that. But by the time you hit verse 30, you realize that this the entire context of this thing is they're surrounded and ready for like ready to endure warfare. All right. So then back to verse 2, Belshazzar, when he had tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought. All right, and they go on about their feast dedicated toward the false gods. Now, as they're drinking the wine and praising their idols, verse 5, immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. So fascinating that it is the fingers of a human hand specified, a kind of theophany, a kind of prefigurement, perhaps even of our Lord Jesus Christ. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Could you imagine how terrifying that'd be? I mean, there you are having your wine and yeah, you see this hand writing on the wall across from you. Well, yeah, right. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Verse 6, then the king's color changed. Yeah. A way of saying he became pale with fear. And his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans and the astrologers. And of course, as we just noted in verse 30, he's called Belshazzar, the Chaldean king. So we always see the Chaldeans linked in. And I treated this in an earlier session. I just want to bring it up that the Chaldeans are a kind of class of magician or sorcerer, a kind of antichrist religion, even from the very start. Remember how Abraham is called out of Ur of the Chaldees or Chaldeans. Yeah, that's not just a sort of ethnic label. That's a false religion. Okay, so the king's color changes, his limbs give way, his knees are knocking together. He calls loudly, bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. So again, most likely Nabonidus, his father, first, himself, second, and then third. So second only to that pair of father and son. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed and his color changed and his lords were perplexed. So good, the whole government's afraid. The queen, now again there's, and I think it is, yes, there's a study note on this, an ESV note, I mean. So queen or queen mother. And that, we don't know if it's the queen of Belshazzar, I mean, potentially, but unlikely, the queen of Nabonidus. There's even a possibility that it could be Nebuchadnezzar's widow still around. And I think the Lutheran study note points that out. May have been Nebuchadnezzar's widow, sure enough. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall. And why wasn't she there in the first place? So that might be that she's Nebuchadnezzar's widow, that she herself was pious and followed the faith, you know, of Nebuchadnezzar. We're assuming his conversion here at the end. So she wanted nothing to do with this, in other words. But then here's what has happened and comes in because of the words of the king and his lords. She comes into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods." And of course, we saw this back in 4:18 and several other places. We'll see it again here in verse 14. And in fact, in verse 14, it gains a little more clarity because it's either the spirit of the gods or the spirit of the holy God. My argument all the way through as I read these is one and the same. They're perceiving this to be the one true God, the God of gods. "There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father," so here a reference to Nebuchadnezzar, "light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers. Because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation." All right, so the stage is set once more for the one true God to do his thing through his faithful prophet Daniel. Verse 13, "Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, 'You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods," or again, if you drop down to the ESV note, or the spirit of the holy God, "I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." And Daniel's like, "Yeah, been there, done that. Don't need it anymore." "Then Daniel answered and said before the king, 'Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty.'" So again, we're back to the theme, aren't we? The Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, here called his father, even though he'd be like a grandfather or great-grandfather or something, gave him all that he had. Verse 19, "And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him." I mean, you just cannot help but reflect on Christ's reign over all the nations of the earth and the way that he reigns. So here, I mean, because God gives it to whom he will, obviously, and ultimately he gives it to his son, our Savior Jesus. Here, though, all the peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive, whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. In other words, God gave him such authority that he could execute justice as he saw fit. Verse 20, but when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, Belshazzar, so you, the son of Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. And the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honored. What an indictment. What an eloquent and powerful indictment of the idolatry and the hubris, of course, that's in view here. So, you know, on account of this king's hubris and his rejection of the one true God, what's going to happen to them? They're going to be destroyed. So what does it matter if you have a Christian nation or not? If you ask Daniel, he'd say, did you not read my book? Okay, 24. Then from his presence, the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. So very interesting language, because it's from the presence of the Lord. The hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed. Mene, mene, tekel, and parson. So those four words put together. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. And I'll do the commentary later. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, which is the singular of parson, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Okay, so let's look at the ESV notes first, those little tiny notes you need a magnifier to look at. Many sounds like the Aramaic for numbered. So thus, God has numbered the days of your kingdom. Tekel sounds like the Aramaic word for weighed. Thus weighed in the balances and found wanting. And Perez, which is the singular of parson, sounds like the Aramaic for divided and for Persia. Thus, your kingdom is divided and given to the Persians, the Medes and the Persians being one. Okay, and then if you look over at the Lutheran study note, chapter 5, verses 25 through 28, each Aramaic word had several meanings. As nouns, they could refer to three weights, the mina, the shekel, and a half of a mina or shekel. As verbs, he counted numbered, he weighed, he halved or divided. And then, of course, Perez, the singular of parson, also sounds like Persia. Daniel interpreted these words to mean that God had judged Belshazzar, found him guilty, and would bring his kingdom to an end by giving it to the Medes and Persians. And these are peoples to the north and east of Babylon. Often no distinction was made between the two groups. And of course, if you want to look at a map, you can go back to page 717 to do that. I don't think we'll take time. You understand that they're to the north and east of Babylon. All right, so that takes us up to verse 29. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Hooray! Because that very night, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was killed. So his reign as the third in command lasted a few hours. He didn't even get to wake up and put on the robe, at least not with any meaning. So that very night, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So if you look down at 531 in your study note, Darius the Mede, I don't really intend to do much more background on him. Not mentioned in any other ancient document. Maybe an alternate name for some other person who governed Babylon after its capture in 539 BC. A likely candidate is Cyrus, whose mother was a Mede, and did not give him the name Cyrus. The prophets attributed the conquest of Babylon to the Medes. You can see that in Isaiah and Jeremiah. There are further references to Darius the Mede. We're going to see that in Daniel 6, 9, and 11. This person must be distinguished from the more famous Darius I, king of Persia. So not to be confused with Darius I, king of Persia, who comes along some 17 or so years later. Okay, so maybe that's sufficient. Darius the Mede takes over at 62.
Is that Darius aka King Xerxes from Esther, king of Persia?
I didn't follow that. I don't think so. Wait a minute. Let me make sure I understand your question. The more famous Darius, is that the king? That's the one, yes.
King,
yeah.
Darius, the king of Persia, would that be like Xerxes, king?
Yes.
Esther book?
Yes, right. I believe so. Mm-hmm.
And
I believe
Xerxes so. was a adjective, was not a title, right? Not a name?
Yeah, that could well be. That could well be. That's always a question when it comes to the rulers, isn't what? Yeah. In many cases, you don't know if it's a title or a name. Okay, so then, 6:1. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom, and over them three presidents, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps should give account, so that the king might suffer no loss. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other presidents and satraps, because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Because if you're the king, why not just reign when you feel like it? You can go out on the golf course and trust everything to Daniel's hand. If any trouble really arises, your cell phone will ring and you can make the call. But why not? He's living the dream. I know it sounds odd to us that anyone would cede power in our power-hungry days, but that's how they thought. Then the presidents and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. And we're already hearing echoes of those who sought to find a problem with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And concoct a kind of plan to get them thrown into the furnace, get them out of the way. So likewise here then, in the Persian rule, they look for a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom, but they could find no ground for complaint or any fault because he was faithful, and no error or fault was found in him. You know, and it's worth pointing out, just at least if for no other reason than to contemplate, because here is a pagan nation and captors, and obviously a very godly Christian man in high office, and he's trying to conduct himself faithfully, and he's trying to do a good job. So it is kind of one of those interesting snapshots of what it's like to live as a Christian in a modern Babylon. Do your best, serve God, not man, and go about your business and conduct in just the way that it's described of Daniel. No complaint or fault could be made against him because he was faithful and he didn't make errors or faults. Verse 5, then these men said, we shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. Perfect. They've got the plan concocted. Of course, the Pharisees do basically the same with Jesus. They're just kind of, you know, like, hey, we're going to happen to bring Herod's officials, and we're going to happen to ask you, Jesus, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? So this kind of entrapment and this kind of trying to pit government against God is, at least it rhymes with what's going on here in Daniel. So what do they come up with? Verse 6. Then these presidents and satraps came by agreement to the king and said to him, O King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the counselors and the governors are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days or shows up when it's 2 weeks to stop the spread, except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. All right, so do pay attention. It's an abstention that's going to be legally required. Whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days except to you, O king, not necessarily that they have to make petition to the king, but just that they have to cease, they have to abstain from all other forms of worship during this period. It's pretty clever. But of course, that's not going to work for Daniel because Daniel's not going to cease his daily worship and daily prayers because of a government edict. And this upon pain of being cast into the den of lions. So just once more to clean it up, verse 7, all the presidents of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the counselors and the governors are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it cannot be changed, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Therefore, King Darius should have not been foolish, should have stopped and thought and contemplated and considered and taken the advice of others, because if he had done so, Daniel would have cleared his throat and very humbly said, I worship every single day, so maybe this isn't a good idea. But this king in foolishness, in pride, and in haste, the opposite of what the Proverbs would give him to do, goes ahead and signs the document and the injunction. And he'll, of course, regret this very quickly. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. And he got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he had done previously. So a few interesting details here, and I don't know how widespread this was. I don't know of any requirement in the scriptures, but just as an act of his own piety, he would turn back toward home from which he was exiled, where the promises of God still resided, that they would return to the land, that the temple would be rebuilt, that God would be in their midst once more. So as a reminder of God's promises, he turns toward Jerusalem for his prayers. And of course, he's on his knees in prayer, and then three times a day he does this. So he just does as he has always done. Verse 11, then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and plea before his God. Then they came near and said before the king concerning the injunction, O king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes petition to any god or man within 30 days, except to you, O king, should be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing stands fast according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Then they answered and said before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day. Then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel. And he labored till the sun went down to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, Know, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or ordinance that the king established can be changed. Yeah, so what was he doing until sundown, he's calling all his lawyers, trying to figure out if there's any loophole, workaround, way to save Daniel, because obviously this was not his intention, and if not already, he soon will be sniffing out that this whole thing was a plot. And he kind of smells the roast, as it were. All right, verse 16. Then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, May your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you. And a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him. All right, so yeah, I mean, some interesting details here and very poignant descriptors. In the rolling of the stone over the den of the lions, you have a kind of foreshadowing of the rolling of the stone over the tomb of our Lord. And of course, as Daniel's going to come out unscathed, so also our Lord comes out unscathed. The king kind of showing probably truly what's going on in his heart, and a kind of piety, fasting, no sleep. All right, 19. Then at break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God. Interesting. Because at what point in time does this kind of piety either enter in or come back? But it shows up here. O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his... here's the second time. So the angel shows up in the furnace of fire with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And of course, he is described as one who looks like a son of the gods or a son of God. And here again, we have a lion, or excuse me, a lion. I just looked down and saw the word lion. An angel in the midst of the lions preserving Daniel. So again, verse 22. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him. And also before you, O king, I have done no harm. So, just a great line. Look, I didn't conspire against you. I mean you no harm. I am serving my God as is right. I have to ignore your command, because I have to obey God and not men. Yeah, when man commands something that God forbids, or forbids something that God commands, especially when it comes in terms of worship. If any pagan ever tells you, hey, you can't worship in this way, the very next thing we should do is worship in precisely that way. And it doesn't have to be bombastic, it doesn't have to be in your face, but it does have to be done to show that we do in fact worship the one true God, and him alone do we serve. All right, 23, the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. And the king commanded, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions. They, their children, and their wives, because the Medes and the Persians don't mess around. It's also a good way of getting rid of any chance that there might be revenge. Just wipe them all out. Now no one's going to be around to get revenge. So justice is done, and obviously Darius figures out what was really going on. Now we get a graphic detail, but this is Daniel's prerogative. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces. So certainly the lions are ravenous and hungry, and this all shows that, again, it was the miraculous intervention of the angel of the Lord that closed the lions' mouths and prevented Daniel from being destroyed. Obviously, the very next day, all his enemies are destroyed. Okay, 25, then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed. Yet one more time we hear that echo, don't we? And his dominion, his reign or lordship, shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And of course, Cyrus, you recognize that name because that's the one long foretold ahead of time by God who would allow for the rebuilding of the temple. So you have this. Cyrus is a kind of pagan prefigurement of the Messiah. Just one of the most astonishing and marvelous prophecies of and prototypes of the Lord. Okay, so let's see. Do you have any thoughts, any reflections, Daniel and the lion's den? It's such a well-known and well-worn story, but we have to be reminded of it all the time, especially for the days that are coming, because we may well be challenged in ways that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ways that Daniel and other people of God were challenged. And we have to entrust ourselves to God And whether God spares us or not, that's his business, but in him we will live forever. So chapter 7, if you look ahead, Daniel's vision of the four beasts. And we've just got like 3.5-4 minutes of class left, so let's not go into this, because it's going to be very interesting, but another challenging section of Daniel, but maybe even more challenging than what's gone before. Chapters 7 through chapters 12 are often called apocalyptic in genre. So whereas we've had pretty straightforward narratives, generally easy flow of things, all of a sudden in Daniel chapter 7 through 12, we get these visions and apocalyptic themes, some prophecies that really would feel equally at home in the book of Revelation, just to give you a little context and flavor for what is to come. So let's jump into that next week. The Lord be with you.